May I have your attention, please?
Your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
Good afternoon and welcome to Attention, Please, a show we call Attention, Please on KPTZ, which we air to draw our attention to the good work being done towards a better informed and more resilient community, and in this case, a more international worldview. I'm Phil Andrus. On this week's show, we'll visit with Kellen Lynch and Rachel Dunn, who recently have returned from riding their bicycles and catching trains in Western Europe, 7 months on the road and on the rails. A year or so ago, I interviewed Kellen about his involvement in the Housing Solutions Network, but knew even then that his interests were much broader than that. As for Rachel, we'll learn about her together, since she and I have never met. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Phil.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. Before we get into cycling for global regeneration, please tell us about your backgrounds, briefly about your backgrounds, such as where you were raised and what you've been doing in your lives that led you to your European travels.
Trying to keep it short, I'm from Houston, Texas, and moved to Bellingham to go to university. I've jumped around the world since, but Kellen and I met when I returned back to Bellingham after hiking the Appalachian Trail. My background is in kind of all over the place as well. It's in agriculture and landscaping and accounting.
What caused you to move from Texas, so far away from Texas, to Western Washington?
Really, when I was in high school, I just wanted a place that was more protected as far as land goes. And looking at the map, there's just so much green space here. There's not nearly as much protected land down there.
Kellen, a little bit about your background. I know that you're from this place, Port Townsend, but more than that, maybe.
Yeah, I grew up in Port Townsend and I've come and gone a few times. I returned first after high school to start a bakery here in town, Dalla Notte, and did that for a few years before leaving again to do something that might have more considerable societal impact rather than just making croissants, though those are important. And I decided to move to Bellingham, which is where Rachel and I met. And I studied energy policy there at Western Washington University and had a mission of coming home to utilize that energy policy background here. And that's what I'm doing now. But all the while, I really wanted to go abroad and see strong and visible examples of success stories, of innovative projects, specifically around energy, but also around agriculture and housing.
Regeneration tour. Regeneration is the word that I think matters the most there. What do you mean by it? And how does it apply to your travels?
Right. We started throwing that term around before our trip, and it was a way to guide why we were going at all. There's a big need to reassess what we're doing societally, industrially, agriculturally, all the ways, all the aspects. And broadly speaking, we feel we need to refocus our efforts and energies towards the renewal and regeneration of our world. Mm-hmm. And that feels fairly fundamental. And you can look at that in so many ways. You can look at that from renewable energy, which is a category of energy that regenerates on a human timeline, rather than coal or oil. You can look at that in a housing aspect so that we're not just creating housing that is accessible only to a certain class, never to anyone else. And you can look at that from the agricultural side of actually stewarding land and soil that will continue to regenerate for generations.
Mm-hmm. The original travel was actually just Kellen's idea. And I thought that I'd hang back and do the Pacific Crest Trail. Been always wanting to. It's like, well, you know, I love energy. I'm grateful for it, but I don't have a passion like you do. I'm much more passionate about farming. It's like, well, what if we incorporate that too? And both he and I are very passionate about affordable housing. So it all started lumping together. And in that, I was like, if this is the regeneration tour, we've got to be on bicycles. And he pushed back actually quite a lot on it as far as practicality goes of how far can you really get on a bike. Thanks to trains aiding in that, it made it a lot more possible. But both Kellen and I were blown away by how far you really can get on bike.
So why did you choose Western Europe, say, instead of Asia or Australia?
For me, I knew of examples already in this domain of energy in particular that we were tracking. I'm sure many good examples from China to Indonesia of strong, innovative energy projects. But I specifically had a connection in a very small town in Bavaria, Germany, called Wilpoldsried, which some of the listeners will be familiar with from some years ago. We had a visitor to Port Townsend. He's actually the deputy mayor of Wilpoldsried, and he was invited to Port Townsend to share about the innovations that their village is doing regarding energy. So that was the big prompting reason to go to Western Europe. And, you know, there's many other cultural reasons as well, such as tracking our own ancestry.
For this part, and I think for most of our conversation, what's going to make it come to life are examples of people, examples of projects, examples of businesses, farms perhaps. And I will leave it to you to start. I have some suggestions, but there must be some individuals in particular, other than the man that you mentioned just a moment ago, individuals who really inspired you.
Well, we can take it from the beginning. I last season worked at Mystery Bay Farm and am in love with cheese and dairies and wanted to find us a dairy in Italy that was making hard cheeses, because Mystery Bay makes Chèvre, and that's really the only, I only know how to make Chèvre. It's going to be fun getting milk next season and trying to recreate what we were making. We're doing Robiolas and other hard cheeses. But we found a farm in the Apennines of Italy, which are pretty close to Bologna. It's due east. It's kind of northern Italy, but not quite Genoa. And found a farm that was run just by four people. And really, three of them were the active workers. Marco, it was his property. And a woman, Vicky, who was from France, that moved there 3 years ago and fell in love with Marco. And then their co-worker, Roberto, who was fascinating in his 30s, decided that he no longer wanted to participate in any exchanges of currencies. And so he would only do trades. And he's been living on their farm for 3 or 2 years now. This farm was up on a mountain. It was 8,000 feet in the air or something like that. It was, no,
not quite, but a few thousand.
It was a few thousand. It was quite high. And it was, to this day, probably one of the harder rides of our lives was biking to the train station and back on multiple occasions, 8 miles dead up. But once you got to the top, and these people too were avid bicyclists, they were doing 100-mile bike rides up and over these mountains to get a burger with them.
But this is a dairy.
But this is a dairy. And they've got just about 20 goats and...
Five cows. Milking cows.
Chickens, countless chickens.
And we were there to support them in their work, their day-to-day operations. So getting up at five with them to milk 20 goats and five cows, and having breakfast all together at 7 o'clock, where the farm table would fill with food. We'd have, you know, muesli and yogurts that were made on site, and breads and cheeses made there, and all sorts of preserves, and then go back out into the barn and shovel the stalls and, you know, do work around the farm, and then return to work later on at 5 p.m. to milk the animals all over again. It was a pretty remarkable month-long internship.
And something so cool about it too was that we showed up in March, and their March is very much like our March. It is wet. There is nothing growing in the ground. We did some preparation of their garden beds, but almost all of the vegetables we were eating were pickled and preserved that they did themselves. And these people are so of the land. They ground their own grain to make bread. They pickled and canned. They had the most beautiful storage room. And then all of the cheeses and butters and things that they made from the animal products.
And all of this is set on a farm that is 150 to 200 years old. And it's just been doing this, you know, since then, since it began. And it's just a remarkable testament. And these are young farmers. Mm-hmm. They're in their 30s.
Yeah.
I'm not a young chicken farmer, and I'm only an occasional 2 months out of the year chicken farmer, but we do raise about 50 meat chickens every year. And every year I look at what we raise and the facility in which we raise them, and I wish I could just make it a lot more. But I don't, because it's more work and I have not enough motivation. What am I getting at? I'm getting at the picture you draw is a picture that's pretty familiar to me, but how do you scale it? How do you propose scaling it up to feed considerably more people than that farm ever could?
Well, I might push back on the frame of that question, right? Because we shouldn't just be relying on a handful of farms to feed all of us. Just like with energy, we need to distribute that load. That's why, you know, solar and wind are so beautiful, because you can put them throughout a community rather than having an oil derrick for everyone. And that's when you get into trouble, when you just rely on one provider or one provider of food like Sysco. If we only have Sysco trucks driving into our town from these major farms, we're not positioning ourselves in a sustainable way. You know, I know this community is working towards farming, and we're actually much farther along in Jefferson County than really any region we came across in all of Europe in terms of local agriculture. And so for this farm in particular, this farm on Montepelpi in Italy, we wish there were more examples of it, that they weren't the only ones in their area doing it, but they did stand alone. And I wouldn't wish them scaling up. I would wish them neighbors that were committed to the same practices.
I'm skipping around. 7 months you were out, and we're here for 29 minutes, so that requires a hop, a skip, and a jump, and many of them. On the island of Lismore, you were a sporting duo. I'm talking about culture here of a different sort. You participated in the Sports and Raft Day. So I want to know about the event, how you participated, and how, in your mind, such events, while seeming competitive, actually build community.
Yeah, so we just jumped from Modena, Italy, the home of balsamic vinegar, to Lismore, Scotland. And Lismore is in the Inner Hebrides on the west coast of Scotland, and it's the island of about 150 people. And we went there again to work, help out on a small croft or homestead. And the second day we were there was their annual sports day, which sports days are held across the United Kingdom and in Ireland. And they are field days, really, to allow everyone to come together and play these traditional sports together. And I didn't know anything about it, but I knew that I wanted to be part of it. And what an amazing way to meet the people on the island, because I think it probably 80 or 90% of the people that live there were there for the sports day. And the day was broken up into different events, like a track and field meet. And so there was, you know, flat races, as they call them, which were like 100-yard dashes. There were hammer throws. There were shot put throws. There was tossing the sheath, which was a small bale of hay that you had to toss over a pole vault.
Deceptively heavy.
Yeah, deceptively heavy. And also it was raining, so the bale was growing heavier by the moment. And then just a jaunt through the bog was the culminating event with a little token you had to get from the top of a hill. So it was an amazing day, and I really would like to see our community consider putting on a sports day for sports we want to be, or events we want to be traditional to us, because mm-hmm. It really did feel less competitive and more communal than any other sporting event I've been part of.
I suggest you put that bug in the ear of Danny Milholland and the Production Alliance, because I think they could make it happen, and that would be really fun. Moving onward, not necessarily geographically, but more generally, where did you find the folks you met to be the most informed about climate change and its present and its potential impacts?
It's a good question. My immediate thought is Wilpoltsried, where the town in Bavaria, where they are at such an energy capital. Though they're doing a lot of energy, they're doing wastewater restoration. Really, what we kept on stumbling across when we were biking through Wales was so many people that were very aware of climate change. We were doing warm showers. It's a bicycle platform that allows you as a bicyclist to come and stay with other bicyclists
And we did this throughout Europe. But when we were in Wales, every single host that we had was in the green energy world. They had a garden in their backyard. It was just so easy to find more local foods, which you'd think, I thought, would be all over Europe. They were doing really fascinating work as well. They were doing tidal wave energy harvesting.
Yeah, I would also add in there Denmark. Just when you go to northern Germany in particular and Denmark, you will see wind turbines, and they're not overbearing in the slightest. They are just common. You see a bigger recognition that, or I had a bigger recognition that there is a global shift happening in terms of how we derive our energy. And that is, for one, motivated by climate change. And two, it's the most economical way to produce energy, period. That is what is really motivating this change.
You'd also see throughout Europe a lot of foresters that were using wind energy as well. So they were growing trees for lumber, but they were also growing, you know, harvesting wind as part of their finances.
Yeah, their portfolio.
Thank you. Yeah, and a lot of farmers had wind turbines. You wouldn't see, like you do in Texas, 500 acres of jam-packed wind turbines. It was a lot more scattered, which I think actually made it a lot more palpable.
And where did you find people to be, I will say, the least informed about climate change and the concerns that you were addressing with your tour and on your tour?
I don't know if we found people that were obviously so uninformed, but what comes to mind most immediately are places in Ireland that are being asked to not burn their peat, their turf, out of the bogs, because it is such a potent carbon sink, and by burning it, they're releasing a lot of carbon dioxide and other gases. But I wouldn't say that these people are, you know, somehow climate deniers or anything like that. There's a really interesting conflict that is happening between folks that are doing what they culturally and historically have done, which we see in our country as well, but in Ireland in particular, it's burning peat. They had power plants as well that ran off peat, as well as their home stoves that ran off peat. And now Dublin and the EU is telling these farmers and these residents in the rural areas of Western Ireland that they can't burn peat anymore. And that creates a pretty serious conflict for folks, and it really makes them feel unseen. And I had a lot of sympathy. I actually grew a lot more sympathy for people that have different cultural and social or societal assumptions, I would say, than I do on this trip. I think I saw more the detrimental impact of the distant hand of authority coming into people's lives. We talk about that, you know, in terms of like city versus rural, right? Like the elites of a place telling the non-elites what to do, right? Washington, D.C. telling us what to do. But in Europe, it's Brussels, right? That's the head of the EU. And that's, if someone is pushing against some sort of policy, they are pushing against this broader feeling that they don't have control over their lives or agency, and they aren't being seen. And that was really eye-opening for me. Mm-hmm. Because it's real. People are not being seen. That's not only an exaggeration, though at times it is an exaggeration. But really, Dublin does not see Donegal very well. And that is a divide.
Along your way, you encountered issues of vacation rentals taking housing from the long-term rental market, just like here. What are communities in Europe doing to address housing shortage issues generally, and the matter of vacation rentals in particular?
I wouldn't say we saw a lot of success stories when it came to confronting the lack of workforce housing in Europe. Their issues are honestly very similar to ours, and there's a lot of reasons that are influencing the loss of workforce housing broadly, especially to tourist seasonal housing. The most extreme example being in the Cinque Terre in Italy and in the Lakes District in England. These are both historically preserved places that have been put under glass and not allowed to grow at a natural way or in a responsible way. And instead you have foreigners coming in and buying up the properties and sitting on them so locals can't. But we did encounter some interesting policies in Wilpoldsried, Germany, which we keep bringing up. And those policies had to do with the city maintaining some control over the newly built homes. And they even had a priority list of who the newly built homes could be sold to. And the top of that priority list were young local families. And number two on that priority list were people that were involved with the community. They might not be young or families, but they were involved in the civic clubs and, you know, making a difference in their village. And I thought that was such a beautiful way to prioritize housing.
And we'll continue to skip around. When I met Kellen in the past, I remember him being on his bicycle. So I was a bit surprised when Rachel was telling us that she had to persuade Kellen, I think that's what you said, Rachel, to undertake much of this tour on bicycles. How did that work out for you, Kellen?
I wouldn't have done it any other way at this point. I can't recommend enough to anyone to bike tour. We saw people of all ages and abilities out there on the road. Honestly, we were the youngest people we saw on a regular basis bike touring, and it was not overly complicated to bring our own bicycles from Port Townsend, from the recyclery, to Europe.
Mm-hmm. And just to add to that, I think Kellen was feeling apprehensive about his body, but just for anyone that is excited about bicycling, your body acclimates quite quickly.
Yeah. And I went through pains in my knees, pains in my ankles, but they actually, you know, disappeared while on the road after working through them. And that's not something that's going to happen to everyone, but my body rose to the challenge, and I'm so grateful for that.
Do you have any notion of how many miles horizontally you traveled on bikes and how many vertical feet you ascended?
We have not done the vertical test, but we believe we've done about 3,000 miles horizontally.
And, you know, really the elevation gains was in Italy, because we were in the north. And, oh my gosh.
Yeah, well, in Scotland too.
In Scotland. But Italy really kicked our butts at times.
And then it's fascinating. The second that you cross over the Alps and get into Germany and Denmark, it is so flat.
Boringly flat. Mm-hmm. So you start aching for hills. And it actually became a kind of a motto of ours that hills are the point. You know, it's like you need that pushback, and you also need that descent to really make it the trip it can be.
And how will your experiences along the road, this 7-month road we're talking about, motivate and direct you in the coming years of your lives? And this is a question for each of you.
I'm feeling it in so many different ways. One of the biggest pieces in this moment is just recognizing how different each of our microclimates are. And so I landscape right now, and I'm really focused on planting native plants and food only for the people. As far as my body goes, just recognizing after doing 3,000 miles of pedaling, how good it feels to just know that you can have momentum and carry on slow and steady. And then as far as the energy and housing takeaways, I am a board member for the Olympic Housing Trust and have been for 2 years. And we are definitely feeling a much stronger heartbeat there to do my best to lock in housing for the working class.
And I would say that some of the biggest changes I've noticed internally for me from this trip, for on a personal level, is around community and like really what does that mean? For me, I grew up in Port Townsend and have had a hard time imagining myself living outside of a town or a city. And after spending considerable amount of time staying on rural homesteads that are full of community, because the community comes to the homestead, right? They're being invited in. I see with myself the possibility of living outside of this progressively inaccessible town in our outskirts and bringing community to us. And that might be in form of the folks that already live here, but it might also be in the form of travelers who are coming through and wanting to participate here as we did in Europe. And that feels like such a resource that I'm not aware of in our town as it is, to have travelers coming through and really dropping in with us, where that has become such a staple in places like Lismore, Scotland, where you have beautiful folks coming from all around the world to this village and participating. And I would love to see that in my life and in our broader community here.
Did you find yourself back at home? Once you're back at home, did you find yourselves more optimistic towards the future of, I'm going to say so globally, the planet, or less optimistic, or some mix of the two?
I felt more optimistic and more grounded coming home. It was necessary to see that we are not the only ones who give a damn about this planet and are doing something about it. And yet the solutions are invariably humble and small scale, and they're going to be. It's going to be a network of a lot of us doing what we can and working together. And that we just have to trust in that. We have to trust in this being a generational effort on all of these fronts, and that really it's always a generational effort, no matter what we're working on or when we're living. The work that we're doing has to be thought of beyond ourselves, and traveling and meeting people really instilled that for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to add into that, there's definitely moments where I can feel rushed, like we have to save the world right now. And some of the most powerful steps to doing our part seem to be slowing down, right? Being on our bicycle, composting, being in our gardens rather than driving to Seattle for a party, like figuring out ways where we can be more content with the smaller things. And it's a really beautiful conundrum of perhaps some of the best solutions are just holding still.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, thank you for those words. Those are going to be almost the last words. The last words will be mine, just to summarize and to thank everyone in the last half hour, if it's given rise to, on the part of listeners or myself or Rachel and Kellen, the wanderlust, a wanderlust with a social purpose. For that, we can thank them. Rachel Dunn and Kellen Lynch, thank them for recounting their travels and for sharing their good intentions that can offer inspiration for all of us. The music you're hearing in the background is Around the World in 80 Days, played on the piano by Yuki Kondo. Attention Please is aired on Mondays at noon and at 5, and on Saturdays at noon on KPTZ. Shortly after its first broadcast, you can find it under the Attention Please section of the podcast page at kptz.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Phil Andrus.